Sophie Cole Prize, and it won honorable mention, which is a real honor. And since then, I've been given presentations about Amelia Simmons and my research, which I think even people who aren't interested in culinary history can see it as kind of a like a whodunit or something, like trying to a mystery and kind of solving a mystery. So I think it might even appeal to other people as well.
It's perfect.
So good.
It's perfect. So in terms of culinary history and just culinary arts in general, could you tell me about how you first got involved with New York Folklore Society and culinary history with that too, if you don't mind?
I'll start with the culinary history. Kind of started with my trip to the Genesee Country Village there and that experience, and being an intern at the Schlesinger Library at Harvard and meeting Barbara Wheaton. But still, I carry over that interest in culinary history to my time at the Arts Council, where I was I managed the folk arts program there, which was sponsored through a grant by NISCA, and fit in food waste whenever I could. But at that time, which was probably early 90s, food waste is, I don't think that people in folk arts even recognized the word food waste at that point. And I remember once, but I had planned several food waste programs. I remember a monastery, something of the Holy Merbearers. Maybe it's a nunnery instead of a monastery, but it's these ladies outside of Otigo that have a nunnery. The Order of the Holy Merbearers is their name, and I did. They raise sheep and they have chickens and they do, I can't remember what they made, but they had a product line, like maybe jam or something. I did a program with them. I did a program with this Italian woman making Christmas cookies at Christmas time. So and there was a Jewish community, and I talked with them about their food ways around their celebrations. And we had a box lunch kind of, I can't remember. Anyways, so we had Robert Barron, who was the director of the folk arts program at NISCA. He was coming and making tours of all the different folk arts programs in the state. And he came to my office, and I had all this stuff prepared, and I had made him some of the recipes from some of the food waste programs that I'd been doing, and I had them all laid out, but he wasn't too interested in eating anything, and I still think he wasn't quite convinced that food waste was a real folk arts skill. But since then, it's really changed. So I was involved with folk arts and started going to the round tables that NISCA and the New York Folklore Society presented every year, and really enjoyed them. They were 2-day or sometimes 3-day events with presentations by other groups who were doing folk arts programs, a lot of good ideas and brainstorming. And I think at some points we even got out of the conference center into the community to do stuff folk arts related. And I just was really, really taken by the whole profession. And although I never was a folklorist, I really worked hard to come up with good programs and to be involved in it as much as I could, because it's a really interesting endeavor. So I go into those roundtables every year. I got to know more about the Folklore Society and became good friends with Ellen McHale, and eventually was asked to join the board, which was from 2000 to 2006. I was on the board.
So going back a little bit, Okay. Can you tell me how the perceptions of food waste changed in regards to what you were saying about the 90s? It wasn't necessarily accepted in folk arts.
I think it's more a perception rather than an experience. By the time I left the... But I would say by the time I left the Folklore Society, it had come into more of a prominence, and I think it was more accepted. I'm not sure how it happened, except that maybe there were more people like me that was going, hey, this is important stuff, and you've got to document it, you've got to present programs about it. Because now, I mean, even the Folklore Society is, I saw on their website the other day that they're presenting programs around food and the food of different cultures. And I think it's great. I'm not sure. I don't think I had much to do with it, but it's definitely, just like my guidance counselor telling me that I should be a home ec teacher. It's just like food in the last, what, maybe 10 years, maybe, or maybe more, has just become a more respectable area of interest. And there's like all the programs on TV and everything. It's this whole thing now where before it was something that chefs in restaurants did or homemakers did, and they were kind of looked down on. So,
great, thank you. Can you tell me more about your time being a board member on the New York Folklore Society?
Okay. I think the most one is I'm not a real enthusiastic board member, and I'm glad to support the organizations I'm on a board of, and I'm currently not on any boards, but I'm not a real meetings person, and all the kind of administrative stuff of boards doesn't really interest me, but programming definitely does. And so the program that I was most interested in that the Folklore Society did was the annual conferences they had. And they were great. Evidently, they've been doing them since 1986, and they were doing up until I left the board in 2006. And the ones I was involved in were like 3-day events where you would go to a place in New York State and just explore all the folk arts in that area for 3 days. It was so great. The one of the ones I remember was in Fredonia, which is way out in western New York. And we went to Lilydale. You know Lilydale? Lilydale is a spiritualist community. that has been in existence since the 1800s. And it's like a campgrounds, you know, like campground, camp meeting grounds where the...
Like a retreat?
Yeah. And there were all these cottages and like with camp meetings, it usually was sponsored by a church, and people would go there in the summer and stay in their cottages and have religious programs and hymn sings and stuff, and it was a real popular activity in the 1800s, but this one was for spiritualists, so that was one of the places we stopped, and we went to this really cool, it was in downtown, I'm not sure of the town, maybe Fredonia, it was this old like sweet shop, like soda fountain shop that hadn't been changed forever, and had like booze and candy counter and the old milkshake machines. We went there. I think we went to a cider making place, but it was a real eye opener about all the folk arts in that area. And the thing with Lilydale, I remember we went to their, it wasn't a church, but their gathering building, and there was a spiritualist who was like picking up vibes from everybody in the audience and telling them, and one of them described, without knowing any of us, said, there's a woman in the audience who's connected to this person I'm thinking of, who always wore an apron, and they didn't get along very well. I mean, she told all these description, but the lady that he was channeling said, and this lady wants to tell you that she's sorry that she treated you the way she did. And Ellen, it was the mother-in-law of Ellen, and Ellen, she goes, that's my mother-in-law. It was so cool. I'll never forget that. So anyway, that was one. There was one at Sackett's Harbor. The last one that I have documentation for was in Watkins Glen, and we went to Watkins Glen Park there, but we also went to the racetracks and got a ride around the racetracks, if I remember right, and this guy talked about the folk arts, folklore of the racetrack and everything. So that I was mostly involved with those conferences and helped plan them. And I also wanted to market them better so that more people than just the people in the folk arts community would know about it, because I thought that it would be something that anybody would be interested in and going to and spending a few days learning about the folk arts of an area.
So, building off that, how has being a part of the New York Folklore Society impacted your life?
Well, first of all, it's given me a lot of good friends. And other is it's given me more an appreciation of the wealth and the diversity of the folk arts in this state, and just give me much more of an appreciation of New York State, which I already just love. And also knowing about the Folklore Society and all it does, and continuing to support them makes me feel really good, because I really believe in what they're doing.
So with that, can you tell me about any influential people that you got interested in and wound up befriending with folklore? I know you mentioned Ellen, but if there was anyone else.
Mm-hmm. John Souter. Actually, I worked along with him in the archives for a while. John was on the board of the Folklore Society. He lives in Ithaca. But he also worked for the Folklore Society, and he did a lot of folklore publications at the archives on how to use the archives in the folklore area. So, yeah, John, let me think. Some of them have gone, but Beverly, there was a lady, Beverly, that worked as a folklorist for the, was it Schoharie County Arts Council? Dan Ward, he is in Syracuse. I think he's currently at the Erie Canal Museum. Yeah, those are some. Vera Chittenden. I know of, I'm not really a friend of his, but I know of Steve Zeitland and follow what he does in New York City. City Lore is his organization.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you. And in terms of folklorists, can you tell me about working on folklorist Bruce Buckley's papers?
Well, while I was working at the State Library, that was when I was in school. I was kind of a library, like a assistant, student assistant, intern, something like that, at the State Library. And the first collection, they hired me. It was a paid position, which was good. They hired me to process the papers of Hamilton Fish, who was a congressman from the Hudson Valley region. And that was a huge collection, 150 cubic feet. And so over the course of my internship, I processed that collection and they published the finding aid. But I still had some time left, so he said, what other collections would you, they gave me the choice of setting up or processing another collection. And I knew that the Bruce Buckley collection was there because of things I had heard from the folklorists I've been working with. And they said, okay. So I processed that collection towards the end of my internship or whatever it was, and enjoyed the heck out of it. That was such an amazing collection. And he was so, he had a process in mind, and he had this whole he categorized all these different areas of folklore, and everything fell into these categories. Very, very intricate system that he created. And looking at his papers, I figured it out and processed the collection with that in mind, so that a lot of it, most of it's in original order from what he devised. Because of that, because I had processed it, and everybody was aware that I had processed it, I got invitations to do presentations of PowerPoint presentations about the contents and everything, and which I did. It was really fascinating. And so I learned a whole lot more about folk arts just by getting into that collection. You just learn so much when you're processing, because you're just right in there at the folder and item level, and you can't help but learn. And this one was really, really rewarding to process.
Looking at his work, can you tell me what exactly you learned regarding folklore, specifically like the categories that he operated in, if you don't mind sharing?
Yeah, well, I mean, he considered everything folklore. It's like some of the things I found in the collection, there was like a roach clip, you know, like when do you smoke pot? Do you know a roach clip?
No, I don't. I don't.
It's like some kind of clip that holds the joint when it burns down. It's a roach clip. Anyways, that was in the collection. Well, I just think of some of the which oh, one was a student had done a paper on the graffiti on the bathroom walls of bars in Oneonta. That was one of the items in his collection was the student had kind of drawn it like it was it, on the wall, had made a drawing of everything that was on the wall. What else? Gosh. It just opened my eyes to the incredible range, like it's incredible range of things that are in our experience that are folklore, according to Bruce Buckley. It also, in the collection were he was one of the, I think he was the first director of the Cooperstown Graduate Program. So in the collection were all these kind of founding documents about. And it was folklore at the beginning. It wasn't museum studies. And so all these like founding documents, like vision statements and things like that, but there were also a lot of his curriculums were in there, so you could see the wide variety of subjects that he covered. And yeah, what else? Things you just wouldn't, I wouldn't expect, but like vernacular architecture, arts and crafts. There were some foodways in there, actually. Not a whole lot, but some. Yes, domestic skills, trades, celebrations in different ethnicities and also religious celebrations, everyday life, a lot about everyday life and things that were considered folklore. Yeah, it was a
Seems
very
like
broad idea he had.
a lot is in that collection.
Yeah, I'll show you that PowerPoint and go through it, and you can just get an idea of the structure that he created and some of the artifacts that were in there.
Could you describe to me the process of conducting archival work? How do you go about your process?
The process I've been most involved in is called arrangement and description. And you take a collection of material. It could be documents, it could be videotapes, it could be artifacts. So I'll tell you the way I approach it. It's maybe a little unconventional, but I seem to have a really innate ability to organize things. It's just kind of comes naturally to me for whatever reason. And so I might not go exactly by the book as far as the way they teach it, but it's how I do it. So you come across a collection, and the idea is to keep it as much in original order as possible, the way it was received. And so we start looking through to see what, how you can think of, how you can conceptualize what the person who gave the collection was thinking about as far as ordering it. Sometimes they're totally not in any order, and then you have to come up with a scheme to put it into some kind of order. So kind of the survey is at the beginning, and you make notes and on what you find, and try to figure out how it's all gonna come together. And then once you've done that, and kind of make a do an inventory and kind of get a sense of everything, then you just start with the first box and open up the folders and see what's in there, and see where it fits into the whole scheme of things. And then usually you refolder things, put them in new folders, and write the description, box one, folder three, or whatever, and you write a description on the folder, and then go through all the boxes and do that, keeping in mind the overarching series and sub you create series and sub-series. Keep that in mind, and then when it's all done, which can take sometimes years. In the case of Hamilton Fish, I think I worked on it for a year and a half. And then you take the boxes, and then you do series descriptions, sub-series descriptions, written out, and then you do, if it's organized to box and folder level, you make a finding aid with all the folders and the names and which box and which series, and then get all that on the computer and create a finding aid, which has kind of overview and then description of the series and description of the sub-series, and then the box and folder lists, and then it's done. And it's so, I just love doing it. I just love doing it. I don't know what it is, but I really enjoy doing it.
Great. I know you mentioned a few collections you've worked on. Can you tell me one of your favorite collections that you worked on?
Think that Bruce Buckley was my favorite, but also that the Foodways, the Foodways collection through the WPA, that one was really, really cool. I also worked on this manuscript cookbook survey project, and that was at the Nisha Library, well, Fenimore Art Museum Research Library. What used when I was there, it was the Nisha Library, and they have a collection of manuscript cookbooks, like cookbooks that are written out. It'd be like your grandmother's recipe box would be considered a manuscript
Yes,
cookbook,
yes.
but some of the cookbooks, manuscript cookbooks they have go back to the 1700s. It's an amazing collection. It's not very large. It's maybe 40 cookbooks in all. But this person, Stephen Schmidt, he was in New York City. He s began to realize that there's all these really valuable manuscript cookbooks in all these archives ar and libraries and historical societies around the country, but there's really no way of knowing what's in them unless you go there and find them. So he came up with this idea of doing a manuscript cookbook survey for an online database, and so then researchers could go there to find out about them, and then if they were interested, they could go to the repository and see them. So I did the part of the manuscript cookbook survey for the Fenimore Art Museum Research Library, and that was really great too, because it was just a description. It weren't scanned or anything, but it was a description, and you had to get in these and come up with enough detail so that a person who was looking for something would be able to find it. One of the things I remember was it's thought to be the first mention of tomato ketchup receipt, and it was in one of the manuscript cookbooks, and so I was sure to highlight that. But that was another one that was really fun to be involved in.